economic events have often challenged existing views of how the economy works.
First of all, GDP growth relative to many recoveries has been quite slow.
I think that maybe the overarching theme is that the economy is still in something akin to first gear. And people should wonder, after all of this time, all of this stimulus, all of this help, why, and if there's anything that can be done to get it out of first gear.
Given the likelihood that the global economy may continue to experience historically low interest rates, thereby making it unlikely that reductions in short-term interest rates alone would be an adequate response to a future recession.
There is no evidence that low rates have had the usual positive effect on the economy as they have in the past.
Does a central bank have to keep actual inflation near the target rate for many years before inflation expectations completely conform? Can policymakers instead materially influence inflation expectations directly and quickly by simply announcing their intention?
I think all the old rules are broken. If you're in a hole, stop digging. That's what we should tell the Fed, right?
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, what a week. As the markets focused on oil prices rising over $50 a barrel, where they remain on this Friday, gold prices picking up a little bit, but what a week it was for the market, dominated by political news. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Up in hour one, we'll be speaking with Louise Yamada, and she thinks these markets are being propped up by intervention, because as we have pointed out here on the program, the fundamentals just aren't lining up for higher stock prices. A decelerating economy, declining corporate profits, and yet markets remain elevated. You want to hear why she is cautious and the divergences that she sees in the market. And also joining me on the program will be Frank Holmes. He's going to be talking about the gold trade, which he still thinks is positive. Two things going forward on that is the fear trade and the love trade. Both are lining up for gold. So Frank will be here in the latter part of the hour. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week.
And I'm John Loeffler. Coming on our program as part of the big picture today is Don Cox. He considers himself much of an historian, and we're going to do some contrasting here between where Don thinks we are and what is immediately ahead for us versus what's going on in the political discourse today, which is a source of distress, needless to say. And quite frequently in times past, Don has been very, very optimistic, but now he's a lot more melancholy and not as sanguine on where things are going, basically saying we're on this train and nobody seems to be interested in stopping it. That's the first part of the big picture today. And, you know, we've seen different changes over the years. I guess we could call them some of the yo-yo years. We've seen recessions, bear markets, volatility. But from 1981 to 2000, that was a time of great moderation, high economic growth, much lower inflation, low interest rates or lowering interest rates, and very few crises. From 2009 to where we are, it's the new normal, the key difference being much higher volatility. And some of the old investment strategies that used to work will not work now. So we need to discuss that. All of that coming up today on The Big Picture as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And this week, Chris Sheridan is sitting in for Ryan Poplava for the market wrap. Well, it looks like, Chris, earnings season is upon us again. It seems to have officially started with Alcoa, and there will be a stream of earnings reports coming on from here on in. So the significance of all of that.
I should say that Alcoa unofficially marks off the start of this earnings season, and unfortunately it did miss estimates, and the stock tumbled around 11%, and that marks the biggest one-day decline in 5 years. So they did not do well for this week. However, if we look at banks and the banking sector as a whole, they have so far come out more on the positive side. So strong results from the major banks have helped improve the overall quarterly outlook for earnings, if that trend is going to continue. as we go forward. One of the big things is we have seen a strong increase in the dollar this month for the month of October, and the dollar did extend its gains this week as well. If you may remember, a strong dollar was a major reason that was cited for a lot of companies that missed their earnings estimates, because of course a stronger dollar puts pressure on their earnings since a lot of their revenues come in from overseas. So we'll have to see how that plays out if the dollar continues to increase going forward. And if so, I would imagine that a lot of companies are going to be guiding lower with that headwind.
Well, Chris, you mentioned the dollar. Now, we have been seeing a lot of movement in currencies.
That's true. So as I said, the dollar did extend its gains this week, and that's particularly against the euro and the free fall that we've seen in the pound sterling. The pound sterling has just been getting crushed as of late. And so a lot of investors are watching that, and that's related to, you know, what we see with Brexit, talk about there being a hard landing with Brexit or a hard Brexit. The fact that we are moving closer and closer to that with the UK leaving and to invoking Article 50 as it's referred, that has led to a sell-off in the pound sterling. So when we think of the dollar relative to the euro or relative to the sterling, the dollar has been appreciating relative to those currencies. So a lot of investors are really paying attention to what we see in the currency markets. There is a lot of volatility there, as well as interest rates. I would say that that is one of the big topics now. The fact that we see long-term interest rates rising across the globe. And if you may remember, Jeffrey Gundlach, he made a big call saying that we were at a major turning point with rates. And that would be a problem if that's true. If we were to see interest rates climb steeply from here or start to increase, then, you know, a lot of those bond investors who, let's say, bought bonds in Europe or other places at negative yields, and in that case, that means bond prices are very high because yields are extremely low, since they trade inversely to one another. If rates start to come up, that means prices are going to be coming down. And, you know, a lot of people are saying that there's an epic bond bubble out there. So that's a bit of a concern. So the fact that we're starting to see interest rates tick up is getting some attention. And actually, we're going to be speaking with Peter Bukvar next week about this issue. He is also thinking that we are at a global turning point on rates. And he's going to share his outlook on the implications for U.S. markets, commodities, and elsewhere.
All right, Chris, let's talk about some of the economic reports. What did we see on the economic front, either here or around the world?
So we saw a very disappointing trade balance report that came out for the month of September for China. And they saw a 10% year-over-year decline in exports. So that really got a lot of people's attention in terms of the fact that, hey, China's economy, which was supposed to be stabilizing here, it might not be really stabilizing. And perhaps we're seeing a resumption of slowing economic growth there in China. Once again, this is the world's second largest economy behind the U.S. So if we start to see problems emerge there further, that's not good for global growth. As we know, global growth is weak and it's continuing to be on a very fragile footing. So that really got some attention this week. However, when we look at the U.S., reports here were fairly stable. If we look at jobless claims, they come out each week. We haven't seen a pickup yet in jobless claims. They were unchanged from the week prior. As we've explained many times in the past, you know, jobless claims are a very good real-time indicator of what we see in the economy. If they start to pick up, then that's definitely a worrying sign that layoffs are increasing and that perhaps we're going to be tipping into a recession. We haven't seen that, so jobless claims were unchanged for this week. So broadly speaking, the trend is still stable when we think about the jobs market. Also, we received a retail sales report for last month, and retail sales increased by 0.6%. Not a large amount, but the results were in line with the consensus estimates. And as Patrick O'Hare at Briefing.com says, that the key takeaway from the report is that consumer spending on goods continues at a modest pace and will remain a positive input for third quarter GDP forecasts.
All right, all of that having been said, what are we looking forward in the weeks to come?
Well, once again, Q3 earnings reports are going to be coming out, so there's going to be a lot of focus on individual company results and how they are guiding going forward. And as I mentioned earlier, if the dollar continues to tick up and if some of the signs that we've seen so far with China's drop in exports, if that is indicating that global growth is really weakening, then we should expect to see that playing out as well in a lot of the corporate comments. So there's going to be a lot of attention being paid to what CEOs are saying about their company and how things are trending. The other thing too, I should say, is, you know, there's a lot of expectations now that the Fed is going to finally be raising interest rates in December. I think most investors now have passed on November, realizing that that's a very low probability event for the Fed to do anything in November, so close to an election. So now a lot of people are looking forward towards December. So that's going to be, once again, something that we're going to be talking about as we go forward. And if we look at the CME Group's FedWatch tool, the market is pricing in over a 50% chance that the Fed is going to be raising in their December meeting. And there have been a lot of comments coming out from FOMC members to that effect. So once again, we'll have to be on the watch for that. As Peter Bukvar is going to mention in our interview with him next week, if the Fed does hike rates while we see interest rates increasing, then he thinks that is going to lead to a big spill in the market. So that's going to be one thing to watch as we go forward.
All right, Chris Sheridan, and thank you for sitting in this week for Ryan Poplava, and we'll see you during the week.
Thanks, John.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his portfolio managers, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Greetings, everyone. John Loeffler here. You know, quite often you hear Jim and me discuss on the Financial Sense News Hour what we call the new normal. But what does that all mean in the real world when it comes to navigating the world's markets and economies in what seems to be a new and steadily changing environment? Well, answering that question is the purpose of our Investment Strategy Conference, which is taking place on October 29th in San Diego. The theme of this year's conference is Approaching the Peak and the Next Financial Crisis. For more information on attending the Investment Strategy Conference and getting this information, that will be October 29th at the Del Mar Marriott in San Diego, contact us at 858-487-3939. Once again, that's 858-487-3939, or you can email Crystal at crystal@poplava.com. That's Crystal, C-R-Y-S-T-A-L, at poplava.com. Just because things are changing doesn't mean you have to be an uninformed or anxious investor.
Well, generally around this time of the year, the weather patterns get pretty severe. We just went through a major hurricane here as a country, but it's also that time of the year markets sometimes get their own hurricanes. But so far, we've had good weather in the market. Joining us on the program is Louise Yamada from LY Advisors. Louise, let's begin with the market. We've been sort of really not going much of anywhere. If you look at the last month, if this is a correction, this has probably been one of the most mild September, Octobers that I have seen in a couple of years. What's your take here?
Well, I think so far you could simply call it a pullback, but we've been a little bit in a dilemma and doubt period because the breakout never really followed through. And a few of the indices didn't quite make it to new highs. And this pullback, you're really playing with first support levels, which we think are important. That'd be the 18,000 level for the Dow and 2,100 for the S&P, and they've been flirting up above and below it this week. If they break, then I think you have potential to move down to the next levels. Whether it gets worse than that, it's hard to determine until we see the breakdown occur. But one of the things that has bothered us is that we have not gotten the buy signals that we like to see come into play. We had it for the Dow. We had it and lost it for the S&P 500. In other words, it went quickly positive and turn negative again. And the NASDAQ hasn't even made it to the positive yet. And that's a little concern, because when the market broke out, we said that's fine, but we want to see confirmation with these monthly momentum buy signals. And they seem a little bit hesitant. So that's a warning. We have 3 to 6 months negative divergences in a couple of indicators. And the question remains as to whether or not the breakout that we saw turns out to be a false breakout, which, of course, we have seen in so many stocks over the last year plus. They break out, then they hesitate up there and pull right back into the wide trading ranges that had been in place a year plus before. So we're on the fence.
You know, one of the questions, we've gotten quite a few emails from clients, because as we headed into the summer, where it's, you know, the old adage, sell in May, go away, and we had Brexit coming up and everybody was worried. We had a couple days of a correction on Brexit, and then it was off to the races again. And one of the questions we get from a lot of listeners, Louise, is, Jim, how can the stock market be going up? The economy is slowed down. It's only growing at 1%. Corporate earnings are, as I report, have been down quarter after quarter. Why is the stock market going up? They're puzzled.
Well, I think everybody's puzzled, including the professionals. And there is some suspicion that there is some manipulation going on behind the scenes. In other words, the plunge protection team, which was established under Reagan years back, may be coming in as the markets start to deteriorate to push them up. They play the futures market, apparently, and I couldn't begin to imagine how it's done. But there is a lot to be thought about in terms of whether or not there's some artificial occurrence going on behind the scenes, because there's certainly been a lot of money coming out of mutual funds, just only beginning to be outweighed. I think 1 week the statistics showed more money going into ETFs than coming out of mutual funds. But overall, it's been a withdrawal, and that allows all of us to be puzzled, to be very honest with you.
Yeah, because we watch fund flows and investors have been pulling out money out of equity funds. And you sometimes think and you go, wait a minute, the economy has slowed down from 2% down to 1%. It hasn't even come close to the Fed's own objectives. We've had 5 quarters of lower earnings by corporations, money flowing out of mutual funds, yet the stock market is going up. And as you look at this, Louise, as you look at this economic recovery and this bull market, some say this is probably the most hated bull market in history because it has lacked greater public participation. But in your career, have you found this to be one of the more difficult bull markets to navigate because there's been so many twists and turns in it? One time we're in a risk-on trade, then we go to the risk-off trade, and it just vacillates back and forth.
Well, I think that's probably true since probably mid-2014, when this wide trading range between 16,000 and 18,000 plus has really been in place, and you get these 13% corrections, and then you go up 19%, and you come back down 13%. It actually has a correlation, and we aren't sure whether it's going to follow through, but it has a correlation to the period in the 1940s when interest rates post the Depression began to be raised by the Fed. And the first time they were able to do it was 1946. And the equity market suffered a bear market decline, 23%, I believe, and continued to go sideways in this perfectly horizontal trading range for 3 years, up 20%, down 20%, until 1949. And then the market took off. So whether or not some of this sideways behavior is a precursor to that, given that we've had only one, the initial interest rate rise since the financial crises, very similar to that 1946 period. We're curious to see whether or not we follow a similar pattern. And of course, one of the things that's intriguing to us technically is that 1942, beginning of that bull market, and 1982, the beginning of the next great bull market, were both periods when the 20-year and 40-year cycles bottomed together. And that is not due to happen again until 2022. So it would be really interesting as to whether or not we continue in a wide trading range with these declines that can trip us up and then rallies, and perhaps by that point in time, we hit a bottom in the trading range that will allow us to take off. Maybe by then the economies will be better if these banks can get hold of themselves and write off their debt, and if banks don't, you know, do these artificial things, which we're seeing with Wells Fargo, which is sort of disgraceful.
Yeah, it's amazing as we look at this, not just the stock market, but let's talk about and move on to interest rates, because at the beginning of the year, it was widely anticipated credit spreads were widening in anticipation of 4 rate hikes by the Fed this year. And anytime you think that interest rates can't go lower, they actually do. And Louise, this has got to be one of the longest running bull markets in interest rates that I've seen in what, almost a century?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. The history of interest rate cycles is that they run from 22 to 37 years. And we're moving into the 36th year of our decline in interest rates. And the interesting thing, of course, is that the reversals from rising rates to falling rates are very sharp. They're like inverted Vs, because the Fed or somebody like Volcker comes in and reverses the inflationary trend that had been in force taking rates so high. And then they begin to decline the way they did in 1981 until today. But the reversals from falling rate cycles to rising rate cycles have taken from 2 to 14 years. If you think about 1946 that we mentioned before, which was the first time the Fed could raise rates post-depression, successfully at least, that was 14 years after the bear market low. So if we were to look at the 2-year note, I think that's the most telling at the moment, because we could argue that we have a base in place from 2008-2009, and we have had an uptrend in place since 2013. You've had a couple of little quick false breakouts, including the one that happened this year. But just this week, we have seen, you know, a lift through the series of downtrends over 2016. And the next stop will be moving through the 1981 downtrend, which would be very impressive.
So as you look at this, we have interest rates that are sort of long in the tooth right now. We've got a stock market where you have a lot of divergences emerging with a weakening economy and declining corporate profits. Let's talk about the Fed, because the Fed is sort of out of step with the other central banks of the world. When you have the ECB talking about QE, the Bank of Japan, now the Bank of England, and the Fed talking about still raising rates, even though they haven't done it and they've bypassed it 6 times this year, they're still talking, Louise, about a December rate hike. What does that mean for the dollar? And I guess a follow-up question, what does that mean for gold?
They're both good questions. The dollar has proved quite strong this past week, and it's been in almost a 2-year trading range, going from 93 to 100 and back, and now perhaps on its way up again toward 100. I think that in terms of the Fed, I personally would like to see one more rise in rates, because I think it would give them some leeway, God forbid something happened again in the economy. But I also think myself, and this is purely personal, I think that we aren't measuring productivity and inflation correctly. We are in a very different two-tier economy, where they continue to measure inflation in the old industrial companies, if you will, even though they've improved due to technology. But if you think of the difference of what's occurred in the old technology industrial sector versus what's been taking place in the information technology sector, clearly information technology has been the leader. And I think that we have to consider that the new industrial environment and somehow taken into the measurement of inflation in the overall economy as being a reduced expectation, because the high technology doesn't create the inflationary bias that the old industrial used to carry. So that's one thing that I think is problematic. And I think productivity, for the same reason, isn't being measured correctly. We did a piece way back in the 90s using the thermodynamic formula showing that the productivity based on the new high-tech efficiency is really soaring. Granted, it can go into a plateau, which maybe it is now, but nevertheless, I think there's a lot of mismeasurement going on that disturbs me in terms of the Fed not moving a little bit more aggressively.
Yeah, because I mean, I can take a look at Louise, two kinds of inflation rates. I know I can go to the store today and I can buy an LED TV cheaper this year than I could last year. But my insurance premiums, food, my utility bills, property taxes, health insurance, you know, the stuff that I have to live on a day-to-day basis, all of that stuff is going up.
Very inflationary, and that is, I believe, not being taken into consideration as well. We always said that, you know, the inflation was coming into what we call the consumer essentials, and that's problematic because there's not really a way to eliminate the rises there, and I think a lot to do with the printing of money, which makes things more expensive.
Here's an interesting question. Where do you think this goes long term? Because it's interesting. In 2008, the government spent $452 billion in interest. In 2015, their fiscal year, $8.5 trillion more debt, the government spent only $400 billion in interest. So the government spent $50 billion less on interest. Louise, what happens when rates start to rise? Because right now, the government is paying a little over 2.25% overall on all its debt. A 1% rise would be another $200 billion in interest.
I know, and I think that's one of the problems that they're probably thinking about. I can't tell you how disappointed I am in this election process, because all these two people do is fight about each other without addressing the issues. And this is a huge issue that has to be dealt with, is the excess spending that's taking place. And, you know, you really need to cut some of the government excess and bring our debt levels down. And I'm not sure that the wars are even included in those numbers.
No. So given your overall assessment right now, we know that we're probably getting towards the end of this interest rate cycle. At some point, rates will begin to rise again, although, as you point out, they do so over a longer period of time. It's not like the stock market, where in a period of 6 to 9 months, you could be down 30-40%. Although, the period from May 2013 to the end of 2013 was an interesting period, because the long 10-year Treasury note went from 1.6% to almost 3%. I thought that was one of the more interesting jumps in interest rates. But given what you see in the market right now, what we do know in terms of fundamentals, at least that's how I look at the market, we do know the economy has decelerated. We're in a 1% growth rate instead of a 2%. We know that corporate earnings have been in decline quarter after quarter. And now we have divergences in the market. Given these facts, what would you be doing as an investor? Would you be taking some profits, raising some cash, sitting on the sidelines? What do you think would be a prudent move here?
Well, we're obviously a little bit cautious. The piece that we wrote for this month, Dilemma and Doubts, Betwixt and Between, I have no problem in taking some profits. And clearly you're seeing some of the stocks starting to roll over that hadn't rolled over before. So, you know, you can raise your stop losses, and as the prices flip back to that, lock in profits by taking some off the table. If your uptrends are broken, you take a little bit more off the table. If support levels are broken, then perhaps you start to exit. But the one thing you do know is that once a downtrend is in place, you're better off out than in, whether that's the individual stock or whether it's the overall market. And let the dust settle, and at least you'll have some powder dry for the next entry point.
Well, Louise, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners about your newsletter? Because you do a lot of work in the corporate world with institutions, but you do have a newsletter that's geared more towards the individual investor. Tell them about it, if you would.
Aren't you kind, Jim? Yes, we do. We have a monthly publication, which gives you about 50 pages covering all the global markets and interest rates and metals, et cetera, and obviously the stock markets. And just send us an email and we'll send a sample and the information. You can just Google my name and the website will come up.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
The European Union represents the second largest economic power in the world, making up over 20% of global GDP. And although it used to be the world's largest, many of its members have fallen on hard times, leading them to question whether the costs of remaining in the union now exceed the benefits. Joining us on the show today is Adriano Bossani. He is Stratfor's senior Europe analyst. And Adriano, before we get to who might leave the EU next, let's set the stage by discussing the UK, which in a very momentous decision did vote to leave earlier this year. Where is the UK in this process currently, and how is this situation progressing?
So after 3 months of uncertainty, the British government has decided that the time has arrived for London to start clarifying its position on many issues. Some 10 days ago, we had an important speech by the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, announcing that the UK will formally announce its decision to leave the EU by March next year. And this is important because until there is not a formal announcement coming from the British government, real negotiations cannot begin. Once the UK has started formal negotiations with the European Union, the member states and the British government have some 2 years to decide both the terms of Britain's exit from the bloc and also, hopefully, the terms of the future relationship. And at this point, we know that there is a key issue on the table. The British government says that it wants to have an independent immigration policy. We need to keep in mind that immigration was a very big issue during the referendum campaign. But it also wants to preserve access to the European Union's internal market because most of Britain's exports of goods and services go to the European market. The Europeans, in turn, are saying that the UK cannot have access to the EU's internal market if it does not accept EU workers in return. So this is probably going to be one of the main issues. Another big issue, of course, is the future of the financial sector of the UK. We know that London is one of the largest financial sectors in the world, and British banks and banks from around the world operating in the UK could lose access to the European market after Brexit. So these will be the most important topics in a negotiation that will last 2 years from an optimistic perspective, but I think they will take much longer than that.
Well, since hitting a low last December at 1252, gold got as high as 1384 this year. Currently, it's trading below 1300. Is this a healthy correction in the beginning of a next move upward in gold? Or is this really a bear market rally? Joining us on the program from U.S. Global is Frank Combs. Frank, let's begin with typically around this time of the year, maybe late October into the end of the year, is traditionally been a very strong time for gold. There are a number of drivers that come into play around this time of the year, and I wonder if you would highlight them.
Sure. There's two demand drivers. One is the fear trade, which dominates most of our psyche care, and the other one is the love trade, which is significantly influenced by the growth in GDP per capita of China and India, Indonesia, Thailand. That region of the world is 50% of the world's population. So what happens when we look at gold stocks and positioning, there is a seasonal pattern. And that seasonal pattern, we see gold bottoms in the summer and starts this rally. And that's usually the beginning of Ramadan, which is gift giving for 20 days in the Muslim world. And so then we have a wedding season, and then we have a correction, which usually takes place in October. And then we get this run going into year end, getting ready for Christmas and then Chinese New Year. So historically, the gold peak is Chinese New Year.
And Frank, are there exceptions to that? You talked about the love trade, the fear trade. The fear trade comes into play anytime there's a geopolitical event, maybe there's a financial event where people feel like their money isn't as secure, so they're looking for a safe haven. So the fear trade, that can come in at any time, can it not?
It can. It's a good observation. So the big surge when we had gold hit 1900 was done in September of 2011. And that is usually an annual surge in gold prices for the love trade. So when you get a fear trade and a love trade combining, then you get that $1,900 gold. So what drives that fear trade? The biggest part of the research we have found is negative interest rates. And what do I mean by that? What will the U.S. government pay you for a 5-year or a 10-year government bond? What's the coupon? And you take away the monthly CPI number, and you can make a determination, am I getting paid more than the inflationary rate, or am I losing money? So what our study has shown is that no matter what country in the world, whenever the interest rates are negative, that is, the government's going to pay you for 1 year or 5 year, a 1%, but inflation is running at 2%, gold goes up in that country's currency. So when we go back into 2011, when gold hit 1900, if you recall that summer, Moody's had downgraded the dollar, and interest inflation has had a surge. And when you take a look at what 10-year government bonds, investors were buying a minus 3% coupon. They're going to lose 3% a year for the next 10 years. So gold immediately surged. And where we got fooled for so many people and myself at the beginning was that Fed funds didn't go up. So rates were basically flat, but real interest rates fell. CPI number fell. And all of a sudden, we were earning 200 basis points, a positive rate of return over the inflationary rate. And with that, gold fell. This time last year was a trough period, and we had negative rates. And then by June of this year, we went from positive rates a year ago. I apologize. Now we have negative rates. So each month, the CPI number comes out. It's so important to take a look and subtract that from a 5-year or 10-year government bond, and it helps you explain the movement in gold.
Yeah, because I'm looking, Frank, at a Bloomberg screen. We have negative yields in Germany, Italy, Spain, Switzerland, Japan. Is this enough of a driver to keep an upward movement in gold, or are we going to need another catalyst going forward?
For those countries, gold has been doing well. So you're witnessing that their currencies are under pressure relative to the dollar. And so one of the things that we did in looking at gold stocks this cycle is those gold stocks that are in the weakest country's currency. So they're paying, let's say, look at South Africa. The South African rand, it's fallen 50%. So gold last year was down 10% before the surge this year, but it was down 10%. But the South African gold stocks are up. Why? Because their currency got clobbered. Australian gold stocks are up. Why? Because their currency got clobbered. But if you translate it back to U.S. dollars, you didn't get as big gain. So in this world, that gold is the fourth most liquid asset class in the world. The fourth most liquid asset class. Gold is money. And so you see that it's important to recognize the trade of gold versus the currency and the gold mines of where the country's producing the gold. And so with that, we witnessed that some of these Australian stocks that we own, over the past 5 years, are up 800%. Why? Because the Australian dollar fell. So gold in Australian dollar terms is up 20% over 5 years. In U.S. dollar terms, it's minus 20%.
So in addition to seeing the price of gold rise as a result of, let's say, negative interest rates, another related sector to gold has been the gold mining stocks. Many of those stocks are up over 100% this year. Of course, they've pulled back quite a bit here in the last month as gold has corrected and gone below 1,300. Do you see gold prices going higher? In other words, is there enough driver, because it doesn't look like, at least in the short term, that the ECB, Japan, or many of the places we see negative interest rates are going to change anytime soon?
No, I agree with you. And I think that people have to recognize that government policies are twofold. It's a binary model. It's monetary policy and fiscal policy. Monetary policy is money supply and real interest rates. That's what drives monetary policy. And the Fed is in charge of those. The government, Congress, the President, and Senate are in charge of fiscal policy. And fiscal policy is taxation and regulation. And what we've seen is that governments have been on steroids since 2008. The G20 meets. It's all about synchronized taxation and regulation. It's not about growth and trade. And they pay lip service to it. When you take a look at, there's always more and more policies coming out that are slowing down the fluid. So even though those rates are cheap and low, it's actually hard to get that money. And it's being usurped away by excessive regulations and taxation. And that's a big reason for Brexit, is the representation and taxation without ability to vote these the EU people in led to that Brexit, the Brits saying enough with this, we're fed up with it. And then we saw the EU policymakers go after Apple, and then they go after Netflix. The French are saying rather than create a Silicon Valley or a Hollywood, they're coming out with, well, if you don't have 80% of films being French actors in France, then you can't have Netflix in France. So it's interesting to watch this protectionism and regulations, the excessiveness, and that's what's hurting global growth.
Yeah, because when the G20 gets together, you hear Christine Lagarde from the IMF talking about anemic economic growth. But yet, Frank, as we look around the globe, you've got the EU going after Apple for taxation. France under Hollande raised income tax rates to 75%. You have probably what could become our next president, Hillary Clinton, talking about raising estate taxes to 65%, raising income taxes over 50%. So if we're pursuing policies that would negatively impact the economy, how does gold fit into this? Because right now, the U.S. has higher interest rates, and that has helped the dollar because the Fed keeps talking about raising them. I don't know how they're going to do it with a weakening economy, but I don't think more taxes and regulation are going to give us stronger economic growth. What would that do to the price of gold?
Well, it is a lag period before it explodes. And I think that the greater worry is a sort of attack on cash. And the fact is that you saw what took place in Cyprus when they had problems. They just froze everyone's bank account, took 10% off to pay for their problems, all your savings, 10%. And then they prevented you from getting your cash. You could get only after a week 50 euros a day, then it was 100 euros a day. You didn't have full access to your cash. So that gave the government much more control of everyone's lives. And I think that what we're seeing every time we hear this is more information, you know, concern on people buying safes and buying gold and silver coins. You're seeing this in Germany, a massive increase in people buying safes and storing bullion coins.
Yeah, because I know that there's a law in effect, and you probably know more about this, running a mutual fund company, is that I think it's 2017, Frank, correct me if I'm wrong, but money market funds have the ability to break the buck.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't want to go on to it, but the regulatory cost is just so incredible. And what people don't realize is that the Federal Reserve is unionized. The SEC is unionized. There are 7.2 million government workers that are unionized, and unions love regulations. So we're just steeped in them. And the Federal Reserve is encroaching upon the SEC's territory. And everyone seems to be positioning for power. And, you know, one of the things is in that process, it just becomes very costly. And the individual small entrepreneur is becoming more and more difficult in the investment world. And now the interpretation of the fiduciary rule, those who challenged Elizabeth Warren over this, she immediately came out and it was in investment news that she was going to have the Justice Department to go after those people. So it's a bullying tactic to push through more of this, what they call progressive thinking, when really it's very regressive. It's really what the EU pushes for, very strict regulation of your life. Individualism is removed. And I was hearing that how this is pushed in Europe is now in Canada, that kids in under grade 6 can't have a birthday party unless every kid's invited. They have soccer for kids under 10. There's no goals because everyone has to be happy. There can be no individual athlete superstar. And it's just interesting to watch this process start showing up at schools in addition to the financial capital markets.
Well, we know what that has done. We saw it in England in the 70s. We saw a lot of that here in the United States in the 70s. And then we had the 80s and 90s. In this kind of environment, do you get more of the fear trade?
Yeah, I think the fear trade is these negative interest rates. So do you think if they raise rates in America, gold will be under pressure in U.S. dollars? So what we have to do is go and buy, if the South African rand gets tanked, we buy the South African gold stocks, and we hedge the currency out. We don't hedge gold. So we've been able to get top ratings, so we're ranked the number one gold fund in the world a couple of weeks ago, and it's because we have a unique approach of looking at quant models for picking these stocks, and also how do we hedge currency volatility for U.S. investors.
So, Frank, if you were looking at gold, it's really sort of, in many ways, a currency play. As you mentioned, you know, you look at Australian stocks, well, the Australian currency is down 50%. So gold stocks in Australia have done well. So do you really have to pay a lot of attention to currencies if you're going to be a gold investor?
Absolutely. Especially when you become a stock picker. you have to take a look at what are the factors, because the costs are always in that country's currency. So the best thing is when gold is flat or rising and the production is coming from, say, Mexico, but the Mexican peso is falling. So you have margin expansion. And whenever you have margin expansion, you get stocks going up. And if you can hedge the fact that peso is falling, which is inexpensive to a 20-day roll, then you can capture that upside. And there have been successful ETFs that did this in Japan. The Wisdom Tree came out with a hedged yen for exporters, and that ETF was great performance. The yen devalued, but exporters had huge, huge gains, and the currency devaluation was hedged. They did the same thing with the euro. When the euro was at 140, you could buy European stocks, and you hedged the euro.
So, Frank, as you look forward right now, gold has corrected. We're roughly around a little over 1250. If you were looking forward 3-6 months from now, your best guess, you see gold prices higher where they are now or even lower?
Well, gold has a DNA of volatility. So we have this cyclical play, and so odds favor in the next 3 months, gold will be higher as we approach the Chinese New Year. And historically, January is a surge month. And one would say, well, what's the DNA of volatility? 70% of the time, it is a non-event for gold to go plus or minus 20% over any rolling 12-month period. So if it is up 20%, it's more difficult to go up another 20%. Vice versa, it's flat. So when we look at it as being that way, then relatively, it's, you know, it's not up one standard deviation. So therefore, the odds are that it can rise between 8 and 20% over the next 6 months. And it would be a non-event for it to go up one standard deviation over the next 12 months, which would be a 20% rise from here.
Well, Frank, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, and you do extensive writing, how could they do so?
Go to usfunds.com, usfunds.com, and sign up for the Investor Alert and Frank Talk. We write every week, and we always have a balanced approach. It's called the SWOT model, and we look at three strengths and three weaknesses that happened in the past week, like Pro Sports looks at the game film. And then we look at what economic data point could be coming out next week, which could be an opportunity or a threat to that particular asset class.
I promise you we have an interesting big picture coming up today on the program. First of all, Don Cox will be with us. Time to do some contrasting what the politicians and the candidates for office are debating versus where he thinks we're headed in the light of where we have come from. That'll be the first part of the big picture. And speaking of the past, prior to what we've seen between 1981 and 2000, we called it the Great Moderation, with high economic growth, lower inflation, low volatility, and few crises. But from 2009 to the present, sort of the new normal, with the one key difference being much higher volatility and approaching crises in many areas, so it would seem. So what is an investor to do? Funny you should ask. That's the question we're going to try to answer as the big picture commences and the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.